I've seen zombie takeout you people wouldn't believe. Zombie takeout on fire, off the shoulder of zombie takeout. I watched zombie takeout glitter in the dark near the zombie takeout gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like zombie takeout in the rain. Time to zombie takeout.
Hello and welcome to Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
And from Chicago's North Side, I'm Scotto.
And joining us is special guest Roberto Suarez.
Hello, thank you for having me, guys.
You're welcome.
Glad to have you on, especially this week. Not only are we reviewing what I'll go down out on a limb and say is your favorite movie.
That's right.
But also, we've got some news that will also play to your strengths as well. This is from Collider. Josh Brolin joins Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya in Denis Villeneuve's Dune. Vanity reports that Brolin will be playing the role of Gurney Halleck, and he joins a cast that also includes Javier Bardem, David Bautista, and Oscar Isaac. Villeneuve co-wrote the script along with Eric Roth, who worked on A Star Is Born, and Jean Spates, I'm going to guess that pronunciation, who worked on Prometheus. That sounded really good to me until Prometheus.
you can't win them all, right?
I mean, as long as they make Gilbert Godfrey Baron Harkonnen, I think I'll be a happy guy.
Baron Harkonnen has been cast. Skarsgård.
Yes. Oh, okay. No, I had that slightly actor. Confused because I was watching the trailer for Jodorowsky's Dune because I figured we might get into that. And that was Dolly. Was going to play Harkonnen in that.
Dolly was going to play the Emperor of the.
The Emperor. Galaxy. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I can't remember who he had in mind for. Maybe Orson Welles. But and the one that I thought would have been great casting would have been Vincent D'Onofrio. He's the one piece of casting that I'm a little dubious on, although I recently saw some footage of Stellan Skarsgård, and I was like, okay, I can kind of, I think I can see it as well.
He's good.
Skarsgård is great in that
role. He's a great actor, but D'Onofrio, he just looks like the guy who played it in the Lynch version.
No kidding. I mean, plus if you see him doing like his Kingpin and the Daredevil series, he's pretty much the same character, right?
You're saying Momoa is going to be.
I was just going to bring that up.
Idaho.
So Momoa, and I don't know if it's confirmed, but just shortly after those news about James Brolin broke, there was news. I believe I also saw it on Collider that Momoa was at least in talks to play Duncan Idaho. And that one, I gotta say, I'm a little bit concerned because Duncan Idaho is an interesting character in that he becomes more important.
In the later books, he is like the main character.
Right. And he becomes a common thread throughout the entire Dune saga. And I don't know that an actor like Momoa is necessarily...
I've seen Momoa in a few roles going back to Stargate, and he's good at playing muscle.
I've actually seen Aquaman.
He's good at action. I have not. He's really good at action. Anything dramatic, he kind of falls off with for me. So I don't know about that. Brolin, I'm dubious on because I've only seen him in a few things. He was great in Avengers as Thanos, but I also saw him in Spike Lee's remake of Old Boy. And the less said about that, the better.
I don't think that was Brolin's fault.
Fair point.
And I think the character of Gurney suits him. He's got that rugged,
Gurney is supposed to be
Patrick Stewart in
the... Patrick Stewart in the Lynch version, which actually was probably not the best casting.
A little too old for it.
Stewart's brilliant, but... Mm-hmm. But Gurney is supposed to be the old, good time, hard drinking, seen it all kind of guy.
And he's the guy who toughens up Paul.
Exactly.
Like, the one who teaches him how to fight.
So thinking about it now, Brolin could be really good in that role.
I mean, if you think of what he looked like as Cable in Deadpool, he kind of has that same
look. He's got the right build for it. And I think he can pull off that character.
I would have said, you know, again, I'm super impressed with this casting. I'm really looking forward. Speaking of Blade Runner, I think Denis Villeneuve did a fantastic job with the sequel to Blade Runner, 2049. So I think if you get the opportunity to see 2049, you will see aesthetically the direction he could take a property like Dune. And the casting, I mean, I read an article, I think it was on IGN or on The Verge, where they described the cast of Dune as the Avengers of filmmaking. I mean, it was like this ensemble of, you know, the best of the best. I would have thought of Oscar Isaac, who's been cast as the father, as Leto Atreides.
Okay.
I would have thought of him in the role of Duncan Idaho instead of Leto. And then for Leto, I think somebody like Viggo Mortensen would have been pretty fantastic.
About how old is Oscar Isaac? Do you know offhand? Ballpark?
I
about our age?
Yeah, a little bit younger, I guess, maybe late 30s or so.
He's a bit young for Duke.
And that's my concern, that he might be a little bit young for the part. But he's still a fantastic actor. I think he's got great range, and he could probably play a little older as well.
True.
But Viggo Mortensen was my dream casting for Leto.
And Paul, I would love to know who's playing Paul, because...
So that's Timothy Chalamet.
I don't know anything about him.
If you didn't see
that
the
name
movie,
is really familiar.
He's been mostly in smaller indie films. He's just starting to build. And I think his big break was last year, a movie called Call Me By Your Name.
I've been meaning to see that. Every time somebody raves about it, I say I've been meaning to get around to seeing that, and I still haven't.
And he was also recently in a movie called Beautiful Boy with the guy from The Office, Steve Carell. Steve plays father, and he's playing his son who's dealing with a drug addiction. And I believe it's based on a true story about this father kind of trying to help his son through his addiction problem.
Okay. And Carell has done some dramatic stuff. So that
it's definitely Carell now in his more dramatic bent.
Carell is pretty fearless, if you think about the stuff he's taken.
But I always have trouble thinking of younger male actors who were really good to cast in things. So
I think the good thing about this Timothy Chalamet kid is he is older, but he can play younger. He's he's kind of small and skinny, and so I think they can get away with him.
And if playing, they go by the book, Paul is like 15, right?
He's supposed to be like 15, right? But you know, if you remember, I would guess that Kyle MacLachlan was probably in his 20s when he played Paul. And with Dune, it's always going to be difficult. In the sci-fi series that they did, everybody had to kind of play older because they're supposed to be much younger than how they're portrayed.
And I don't know how they're going to do the later books where they have like the young girl.
Toward the end of Aaliyah starts at the end of the first book,
right?
And she's always challenging. Witt was great.
She's supposed to be a toddler kind of thing by the time the Dune ends.
To speak to the other versions, Lynch's version was fun, but has very little in common with the book.
Right.
The Sci-Fi Channel version was close. I think that's gotten it the most correct so far.
Somewhere in both, I think if you could pair Lynch's aesthetics with the Sci-Fi Channel's story, you'd have something closest, you know, possibly to the realization of that. And just wanted to comment on, you know, how are they going to do some of these things in the later volumes? I'm surprised this is getting made at all. I would say let's wait to see if they do with this first movie. They'll worry about, you know, what to do later on.
The Sci-Fi Channel version worked because it was a miniseries.
It worked.
They had a lot more time to pack things in. It's very hard to do Dune in even just the first novel. A single film. It has a glossary, for crying out loud.
This has been very unclear, but my understanding is that Villeneuve is actually doing two back-to-back movies. This is being filmed Lord of the Rings style as what I think is supposed to be a around 4-hour epic.
Of just the first book. That could do it.
Just the first book, but it will be released on subsequent years. Mm-hmm. So Dune Part 1, Dune Part 2. Now, again,
Not sure about that. Yeah.
With the failure of the box office failure, although it was a critical success of Blade Runner 2049, I don't know how much confidence
good point
studios have in Villeneuve. So I keep hearing, I mean, you see this cast and you're like, oh my God, this is an incredible cast. We'll have to wait and see when stuff is more solid when it comes to the actual length of the movie and whether it's going to be a multi-part film or not.
I hope so, because, I mean, as much as I like the sci-fi version, it was clearly TV, and I would love to see a faithful big screen version.
Yeah, and it has not aged well. I own it, actually. I have it right here in front of me. Look at that. It's right here.
I didn't actually see that. I don't think you were on camera when you held it up either.
Yeah, so I have it here. But it's again, story-wise, they have the time to let the story breathe and play out. But when it comes to like the special effects and the costuming and stuff, it's just very low budget.
It was a TV budget.
Yeah.
And it was a cable budget.
The sequel they did for the Sci-Fi Channel, which was called Children of Dune, but actually covered both Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, is I think a better film.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a better series.
And if I recall correctly, started young James McAvoy.
One
of his first big roles.
Leto the Second or Leto the Third at that point. I can't remember. Yep. So.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I hope it gets made. I hope it lives up to the book. And moving on to this week's movie, which is from 1982, Blade Runner, The Final Cut. We chose The Final Cut because that's the one that Ridley Scott had the most input on. It's generally considered to be the best. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by the Void Conf Machine. Do you know what you are?
And also brought to you by Unknown Pills. Take one. It'll make you smile.
And sponsored by Choose Eye Emporium. Wait until you see what you can see with Choose Eyes.
All right. So we have, of course, what this whole series has in common, the year 2019, the future. And you know, out of all the films we've done so far, this one has nailed 2019 the best. Think about it.
Do we have flying cars?
We've got constant rain. We got people eating lots of sushi and ramen.
Okay, yeah.
And we got advertising out the wazoo. Our robots aren't as advanced. It's not as dark, and there are no flying cars. That's the difference.
And I also was reminded that the Fifth Element completely ripped off the food vendor from this movie.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're right.
Well, and both movies really ripped off heavy metal, that kind
of
aesthetic from the Moebius, you know, type
of course.
Yeah. All right. So we have, I guess, a guy who just when he thought he was out, they pulled him back in.
That's right.
He's a retired Blade Runner who's a person that would hunt down these androids that were not allowed on planet Earth. We made them, we use them, but we don't want them living among us. And I guess for good reason, considering some of the stuff they do when they're on the planet Earth.
But would they do that stuff if we weren't trying to actively kill them?
I think it was also the short lifespan too.
Perhaps.
That was a pretty dick thing to do to somebody.
Well,
yeah,
that's true. And if we hadn't done that as well, you know, if we weren't actively trying to make them die early, I doubt they would be so violent.
Give them feelings, but only make them live for 4 years. So they pull him out because there are four of these replicants, they're called, on the planet Earth in LA. And, he's got to track them down. And he does do a fantastic fucking job of taking them out.
Well, two of them. I think the other two died from other means.
Well,
he died. The three of them he kills. Two he kills, one dies. One just expires.
One just expires and wants to tell him some parting shot. And the other one he is rescued from, actually.
It's his gun. His gun kills him, it's not him. Yeah.
Right. He chases these down, but what they are trying to do really is find their maker so they can live a little longer than 4 years. But when they don't get the answer they like, they go on a killing spree. Well, they kill a few people at least.
Mm-hmm.
And he tracks them down, and hilarity ensues. Really, it is a very simple plot if you think about it.
Blade Runner is a loose adaptation of Philip K. Dick's novel "Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?" Mm-hmm. And early screenwriter Hampton Fancher, who worked on an early treatment of it, borrowed the term Blade Runner from a 1979 William Burroughs novel called Blade Runner, a Movie, a novel called Blade Runner, a Movie. And the term originated in a 1973 Alan E. Norse, I'm going to guess pronunciation on that, novel called The Blade Runners. In both, it was a title for someone who smuggled medical supplies, particularly scalpels.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, because if you think about it, he doesn't use any sort of blade.
No, it's an...
Nobody uses a blade of any sort.
I've wondered about that for a long time.
The way that I heard it explained in the context of the Blade Runner universe is being run by a blade. Like the person who runs a blade into you is the Blade Runner, right? Uh-huh. Like the person who comes to execute.
Actually does the kill. Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of basically supposed to be a synonym for bounty hunter.
Okay. It was just a throwaway term that Fancher used in the script, and Scott just loved it, fell in love with it, and titled the movie that.
Right.
Now, I also really liked in the very beginning, the studio logo actually fits the movie. I love it when they do that. They modify the logo to fit the style of the movie.
Yeah. They did that a lot at this time, like Indiana Jones with the Paramount Mountain.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of things they did a lot at this time, I totally forgot about long opening credit sequences.
Really? Because, I mean, there's a lot of movies with them.
I haven't seen one from this era in a while, and I totally forgot that they actually gave you time to, you know, hit the bathroom and get your popcorn and whatever.
Yeah, and they're very simple credits. It's just titles in front of a black screen with the Vangelis music playing in the background. I mean, it's very simple in that sense.
Now, one thing I've never really been completely clear on about the movie, are the replicants mechanical or organic? Because they're referred to as androids.
Right, but they are supposed to be organic. They are supposed to be basically, I mean, even in the discussion that Rutger Hauer's character has with Terrell, they're talking biological concepts, right? DNA, a viral replication, all very much. The thing is, they are organic components that have been manufactured.
They're lab-grown humans.
They're lab-grown organic components, and that's what makes them replicants, which is also the reason that they decided to not use the term android in the movie. As opposed to the term replicant, to kind of distinguish it from just being something that's a robot. In the book, a Philip K. Dick book, they are supposed to be more robotic.
Okay.
It's more something more akin to what we've seen in like the Westworld TV series. Right.
And I think in the opening crawl, it does say robotics or androids or something along those lines to connotate mechanical.
Mm-hmm. Was that crawl in the original?
So the original movie did have the same.
It did have the crawl.
There is a different print of the movie called the work print, which has a different crawl. It starts with a different text in the beginning, but the one that appears in the final cut is the same from the original theatrical cut.
This is my first time seeing this cut without the narrative and all that. So I'm actually trying to figure out which one I like better, tell you the truth.
I've never made it through the theatrical version.
I would say if you want to delve deeply into this stuff, there is a great book by an author. I'm pulling up his name here. It's Paul Sammon. Sammon, and it's called Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner. And there's actually, I've read the first edition. There's a new edition that came out when 2049 came out, so last year. But if you're wanting to, if you want an in-depth exploration of the ins and outs of all of what went into Blade Runner, the drama, the infighting, the issues with the studio, and what led to all these multiple cuts, I would highly, highly recommend that book.
Because the thing is, with the theatrical release, that is much more a film noir you know, style film.
Yeah.
Whereas this is more of just the dream, you know. It's you're just kind of, I mean, they're both very interesting, I think, but.
And I remember hearing at some point that Harrison Ford actually phoned in those voiceovers, like acted them poorly deliberately because he hated the idea and he wanted them cut from the film.
Yeah, and he that was all done after the fact. So the problem was the work print that is included in the anniversary set that came out a few years back. Of the movie, which also included the final cut. In that sense, Ridley Scott has been different from, say, people like George Lucas, who don't give you the old versions of the movie. Yeah. Ridley Scott included like all five versions that exist are in the
Blu-ray. My notes say
there's an international cut, there's a director's cut, there's a final cut, and there's the original, and there's probably one more out there.
Wikipedia actually lists seven.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they made five of them available.
Oh, okay. Five are available
in the disc.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But in what made me fall in love with this movie and why I was so to this day I consider it my favorite movie of all time is that it happened in a period in my life where the two things that I loved the most was science fiction, particularly things like Star Wars and Star Trek, which was kind of the big thing at the time. And I was totally into the old Humphrey Bogart, movies. I would go home and I would rent movies like, you know, like James Cagney movies and Bogey movies and, you know, Maltese Falcon, these kinds of things.
Kind of the point of this. It was the
merging of those two types of genres into this. You know, to me, what is to this day one of the most fully realized worlds, when you talk about using a film as world building, this to me kind of exemplifies what it is to build a world that feels like a true existing living thing.
And speaking of the world, the effects are amazing.
Oh, yeah. Good God.
This could be released. Really just... This would look good today.
Yeah. Well, and most of it is in camera. Practical effects.
Wow. Right.
Yeah, I mean.
Oh yeah.
That's why it looks so good.
Looks so good. I mean, you can't hide that. I mean, now granted, the final cut does correct some issues.
Okay.
If you go back to see the original theatrical cut, I don't know if you remember this. The scene after Tyrell has been killed, and Deckard is parked outside of the Bradbury Hotel, kind of waiting. Yeah. And a cop shows up in one of the spinners.
Right.
Spinner drops and tells him, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "Blade Runner, blah, blah, blah." And so the guy says, "Okay, have a nice day." You could clearly see wires pulling that spinner up and down in the theatrical cut. But by the time the final cut rolled around, that was very easily erased.
But small things like that, I don't really care about.
Yeah, you don't really mind.
Those cityscapes are just breathtaking,
and that's all Douglas Trumbull modeling. I mean, that is classic. His typical, what you would call bigatures, right? Which are gigantic miniatures. These are miniature buildings, but they were done at a scale way bigger than anything that had been done up until that point. I mean, these were things that would take up entire warehouse size spaces. And again, if you ever check out the book, there's plenty of material too in the anniversary disc that includes documentaries and stuff. You can see these amazing cityscapes that were built by Trumbull and his effects team, which is just breathtaking.
Yeah, the one issue I have with the movie, and it's the thing that stopped me when I tried to watch it last year. I hadn't seen it in a long time. I found it online. Watched about half of it one night. It was getting a little late, so I stopped it. Never got around to get back to it. And the only issue I have with the movie is the pacing. It is very, very slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not... And think at the time, I think Ford had already done at least one, if not two, Star Wars movies by now.
He had done... he'd done two Star Wars.
And Raiders, yeah.
Cameo
have come out too.
Raiders... He'd been in Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
So, but think about
crazy career.
Think about what a weird turn it was for folks to go to the theater, and all of a sudden you're expecting an action film. Mm-hmm. So this was very atypical for the time. You know, at the time, what people wanted to see was either the action level of a Star Wars or horror like Alien, right? In their sci-fi. So this idea of actually we're inviting you to come to the theater to do some thinking. That was not, you know, a commercially viable proposition, which is what led to the creation of what ended up being the theatrical cut, which Ridley Scott didn't really like. I mean,
that's why they put the narration
after the work print. Exactly. After the work print was shown to audiences in 82, the feedback was so negative that they said, we have to salvage this thing. And the two things that they did primarily was add the narration, which Harrison Ford kind of added very haphazardly after the fact, and add a happy ending, which makes absolutely no sense in the theatrical cut. At the end, after the elevator doors close, we then see footage, which is actually outtakes from The Shining. Remember when the helicopter is swooping over the forest as you're leading to the hotel in The Shining? They use some footage of that, and then we zoom in on Deckard and Rachel in a car, and the narration says something to the effect of, so we got out of the city, and we went to live our happy lives someplace else. God. And I found out that Terrell's secret was that Rachel has unlimited lifespan, and we live happily ever after.
I don't remember that ending.
And wow. I'm thinking here, wait a second, if what's the point of having an off-world colony, and if people wanted to leave the Earth, if you can just drive a few miles north, and you're like in New Hampshire all of a sudden, it makes absolutely because no sense.
The hotel was fucking haunted. Yeah. He's gonna kill them with an axe.
The world is a pigsty. It's just completely destroyed. No, you can just drive a few hours out of town. You're in Canada or something. It's like, really?
I need to look that up on YouTube.
It is unbelievable. So, on the other hand, the other piece that's to me, the one thing that I kind of hold on to from the original cut, that is anything that has to do with implying that Deckard is a replicant. Because to me, the story works best
if Deckard
is not a replicant, right?
Yeah, and I don't see. I mean, they pose the question that if he's a replicant, but there were no other signs that he was actually a replicant.
Well, the key thing that Scott did, which is a scene that is not included in the original theatrical cut, is the scene of Deckard having a daydream about a unicorn. Mm-hmm. There's that moment in which Deckard is sitting by the piano, and as he's thinking, you see an image of a unicorn.
Right.
By the way, an outtake of another Ridley Scott movie. That
was from Legend. I thought that.
Legend.
Yeah. So
Legend came later, though.
No, it came... did it come later? I think it
I believe before. So. I think that was like 85, 86.
And maybe I'm completely wrong about that.
It looks like a scene from Legend.
They may have used it for Legend.
It didn't come out until the director's cut in the early 90s and then eventually into the final cut. So it's very possible
I see. So he took that in post. Took it in post.
But the idea here, remember the scene where Rachel comes to confront Deckard and she tells her, I have all these memories.
Right.
And he's like, they're not your memories, they're implants. Mm-hmm. So the idea was by giving you this dream sequence and at the end having him find the unicorn, it's a signal to Deckard, we know what's in your memories.
Right. Particularly Edward James Olmos's character.
Character is basically Gaff is telling him, you know, by leaving this behind, I know that you are you're a replicant. But to me, that completely deflates the point of the movie. If there's one thing that the movie is about, it's about a man recognizing the value and the humanity of these replicants.
Right.
If he was a replicant all along, then there's no journey for this guy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Although that wasn't just included in the movie. The novel hints at the Deckard a replicant problem by having Deckard casually mention that one of the indicators of an android is lack of sympathy to other androids. And his interlocutor then points out that given his job, that means Deckard could be one too.
Well, and Philip K. Dick played a lot with that idea, but that I think his approach was really more of a metaphysical thing. Like, you know, if you get to the point where you can't show empathy for others, then you might as well be an android.
Okay. Right?
Yeah.
Kind of that sense.
That's exactly what I was thinking, too. It was more about, well, who's really human? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, what does it mean? And what does it matter if he is or is not an android, right. You know? But yeah.
I kind of wish the movie had delved more into the philosophical stuff. And I guess that's more of a issue with the book, but
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the book, the framing of the story is similar to the book. The book kind of delves into a lot of stuff with religion also. And it delves into drug use and it delves in, Deckard is actually married in the book. Deckard actually owns a artificial sheep that he keeps on the roof of his house. It's really weird. I would actually suggest there's a few years back, a comic book company, I want to say it's either Dynamite or Boom Studios, they did a graphic novel adaptation of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, full text graphic novel adaptation.
Wow.
So it's, I want to say it's like 8 volumes long. It's
man.
But it is, to me, the best way to read it, because his Dick's writing can be a little bit out there. Mm-hmm. And even though it's a short book, some of the pieces are hard to comprehend, and having the text illustrated really kind of helps contextualize the story a lot better. And you can find those, I'm sure, if you do a search on Amazon for the graphic novel adaptation of Androids, you will find the copies there.
And speaking of the noir aspect, it has a very diesel punk feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is odd for a movie set at the time, you know, into the distant future.
Right.
I mean, I guess did that genre even exist when they made this? I mean,
creation of it in a way.
In a sense, when was Brazil?
Brazil was after.
Because that's like one of the early diesel punk films that I'm aware of.
Part of what Scott wanted to convey in this movie was a sense of building on top of building, like
yeah,
you know, like layers, right? Like if you look at a wall, the it's probably inches thick with posters and plaster and paint. You know, that idea that we just kind of kept building on top of what was there before, so we had just kind of become this society of continuing to, the foundation is this old stuff under all the new stuff.
Mm-hmm. And you couldn't even tell if it was just cloudy out or if they had just built so much to obscure the sky.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah. Is it pollution or what, you know, like it's a combination of things. Yep. Yep. And you know, we get this ominous blimp going around saying, you know, find a new life in the off-world colony. So
yeah.
Obviously people have kind of given up on Earth at this point, right? It's like, if you really want to live the good life, you're supposed to be going off-world.
Like, my guess, those flames in the cityscape are oil refineries.
Or burning wastes. You know, they don't know what to do with all the trash that's been created, so you're just burning it and using it to power things.
It's true.
It's all what they borrowed from Mobius.
I mean, if you see like an oil refinery, yeah, it's just shooting flame out constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting because in some ways it does predict kind of where we are in the future in 2019. I don't know if you've ever seen
I think it footage. Comes pretty close to nailing it.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was watching a series on YouTube on Shenzhen. You know, the Chinese nation. There's a city in China where a lot of the products that are manufactured us here in the U.S. and across the world, especially in the electronics business, come from Shenzhen. It's a massive megalopolis of manufacturing, and it was like looking at a Blade Runner landscape.
Yeah.
And you know, street vendors up and down the streets with like these raggedy shops selling computer chips and hard drives, and this videos that I saw is about this guy was attempting to build a cell phone out of buying parts in the streets of Shenzhen. And it was literally like something out of Blade Runner. So in that sense, you can see that prediction kind of coming true. On the other hand, the fact that Blade Runner didn't predict cell phones.
So we still have newspapers. Huh?
We have newspapers. And you can use a video phone, but it's an actual machine that you have to go to and, mm-hmm. and push. A mobile technology was not even in the thought of.
And 16, in this world. 16 years after Star Trek?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Right. You would think the communicator, would have already set some foundation and there.
Wasn't the car phone already a thing by 82?
I'm sure a version of it, but CB radios were a thing,
That's those true, yeah. things
were around, but it just didn't quite become part of this world.
Now just onto the supporting cast a little bit. Mm-hmm. It was kind of odd to see Edward James Olmos looking so young.
He was underused in this, honestly.
And then I realized this was just 2 years before Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Yet he looks so much younger than I remember him.
Yeah. He was still very much, I think, starting in his career at this point. So this was kind of an early break for him, but it's a very small part. I mean, the movie really is carried primarily by Harrison Ford.
Of course.
To a certain extent, Sean Young and Rucker Hauer, I would say, are kind of like the trinity of
later Hauer. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And speaking of Sean Young, not really known for her acting prowess, but her robotic performance really kind of works in this.
Oh, I mean, I pick up she's, a robot, I think a couple minutes in, obvious, I thought.
And the fact that it took 200 questions to figure it out, you're like, really?
What?
And her answers were clearly very practiced.
Yeah.
Which, again, probably down to her acting, but it worked for the role.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly enough, there's always been a ton of debate about Harrison Ford and Sean Young having zero chemistry in this movie.
That's the next thing in my
notes. That kind of gets debated back and forth. The relationship on set was apparently incredibly contentious, and they did not get along in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, Harrison Ford had huge problems with Ridley Scott. I mean, his famous complaint was, "I am in a movie about a detective that does no detecting." he was kind of frustrated that the story kind of was trying to be one thing but another. Plus, Ridley Scott is known for notoriously difficult shoots. Those scenes towards the end when it's raining and he's getting beat up. I mean, it was just a very miserable shoot. So Harrison Ford kind of pledged never to work with Ridley Scott again after that. I think they made amends later on in life. But going back to the piece with Sean Young, I mean, I think it works because in a way, too, it's not so much about the relationship, but as it is about Ford kind of finding his humanity. It's like about Ford, finding that he can develop feelings for, let alone for someone else, but for a replicant. Right.
So I'm not sure. The thing is, she reminded him of someone from his past, whoever those pictures were of on the piano.
Old pictures. Yeah.
And he knew she was a computer, a replicant. Mm. And maybe it started where he was just using her for her, services, I guess you could say.
Sure.
But yeah, that whole seduction scene.
Yeah, that's rape where I was scene. Gonna go next. Yeah. Sexual assault set to seductive sax music.
Right.
Yeah. Right. That's the 80s.
That's a hard
every damn 80s. Love scene in the history of cinema there. So I think that's how he was approaching this.
Mm-hmm.
That this wasn't an actual relationship. This was kind of a plaything.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting take.
Between that scene and the fact that the replicants basically got screwed by the government.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to be on Deckard's side?
Towards the end, I think maybe his view of her changed because of that, because what he witnessed. Well, mostly, of course, because Roy saved his life instead of, letting him go.
In the narrated version, there's some silly narration and that beautiful scene when Roy's dying and it's this nice, quiet him just looking at him die. in the original, in the theatrical version, he's like, and in that moment, I realized that he realized that life was a precious thing. You know, it's a completely dialing it in.
You do a good Harrison Ford.
Yeah, it's terrible. But I mean, I think that's part of what happened, right? The replicant teaches him something about the value of life and of humanity in that moment.
But it's difficult not to side with Batty for me.
Totally.
Of course.
I mean, he's the quintessential, even Terrell calls him prodigal son, right? He was cast out, turned into a slave, and he just has the same questions all of us have had. You know, who am I? You know, who's my creator? Why did you make me the way you made me? He's just a child in many ways, kind of trying to find those answers. And when those answers aren't satisfying, you know, he reacts violently like a child would, right? And when he's very much a little kid, the fact that he's has a 4-year lifespan also makes you think he's kind of behaving like a 4-year-old. I mean, I don't think the violence is necessarily because they're violent by nature. It's just like they're wanting to live, wanting to learn these things. And they are that there's a dissonance that causes them to then react violently.
They're probably programmed to be as intelligent as adults,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have the socialization
or the emotional maturity.
I understand him killing Tyrell for not getting the answer he wanted, but did he really have to kill Larry without his brother Daryl or other brother Daryl? Come on.
Yeah, at that point he kind of goes crazy at that point. I mean, he has that weird
turn where he's very rational and very mm-hmm. intimidating for most of the film.
Yeah.
But then at the end he just takes that completely insane turn.
Yeah.
Where he's running around in his underwear
and howling and
yeah. Yeah, I mean, and a lot of that was improvised by Rutger Hauer. That entire speech, the Tears in Rain speech, was completely improvised by him.
No shit, really?
Iconic moments in science fiction.
Yeah, yeah. One of the most important, I think, beautiful cinematic moments in sci-fi history, and it was Rutger Hauer just completely
coked out of his mind and improvising.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
Allegedly.
Amazing, huh? Speaking of Larry, though, William Sanderson, for those who don't know New York. That ending gets really weird with his toys, and particularly when Deckard sneaks in.
Oh yeah.
And you see, and we know that Daryl Hannah is right there, you know, waiting to jump on him, but he doesn't. And that whole scene, all those weird characters in there, it has this kind of weird broken down Victorian feel to it. I mean, again, it's that idea of like layers of different times mixed together mm-hmm. to create this future.
And even the way she attacks him is kind of comedic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, with weird gymnastics and impractical, the things that they do. But again, kind of speaks to the naivete of them, right? I mean, they're just kind of reacting more than thinking rational.
Yeah, true.
I mean, this set, of course, is reused throughout the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Genesis, the Tonight, Tonight, Tonight video right. is literally just them performing on this set.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, good point.
I watched the video right after the movie, and there are still things from the movie, like props and stuff,
so You weren't being facetious. It's literally performed on that set.
Oh yes, literally. It's just, I mean, the boards that Rutger Hauer puts his head through. Phil Collins puts his head through.
Okay, it's a nod.
It is.
I'm gonna have to watch the video
entire set.
Well, and I believe it was filmed on location at the Bradbury Theater, which was a landmark.
Oh, it's an actual thing. Okay,
that had been broken.
That was a nod to Ray Bradbury.
It's a real building. It's a real building.
And it was a kind of a condemned site, and it became a practical set which they could break and bust around and do all that stuff on.
And that whole ending, it's you said it was very 80s. It is also kind of a nod to a lot of 70s sci-fi, where that gets just kind of beautifully weird, like Zardoz,
Yeah.
Oh, hey, nothing gets as weird as Zartos. let's hold the phone there.
At least Rutger Hauer's pants were a little bit longer.
Yes. And I'm saying, wearing a diaper. There are bits in Zardoz and Logan's Run and even THX. Yeah. They get that weird.
Yeah, well, because it was about asking the questions and it was much more of a thinking science fiction than it was a,
which was much more 70s
pew Star Wars type thing, which really kind of was what the 80s kind of became with with sci-fi. One thing you mentioned earlier, Rutger Hauer's howling, I don't know if you noticed too that every replicant has an animal counterpart in Blade Runner. There's a lot of symbolism here. So you have the wolf with Rutger Hauer, with I'm spacing on the replicant's name all of a sudden. And then
Pris is Daryl Hannah.
Pris is Daryl Hannah, and she's the raccoon. She has the, you know, she's
right. Okay.
Then the snake, Zora has the snake.
Where did he get the scale? Because I missed that part.
He finds it in the bathroom when he's at first checking the place that they had told him to go check out. Okay. They had a lead in a place in a hotel. Which is where he finds the pictures.
Because I missed that part. He's doing the whole enhanced thing with the photograph, which I got a huge kick out of. Because it's
Ford
such a
was cute. Right. That was the extent of his detective work, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like done in the first half hour.
Exactly. He steps into the bathroom and it has that fun scene where the neon light is kind of blinking on and off, and he kind of clicks it until it comes into frame. It stays lit, and he goes into the bathroom and finds the scale there.
I'll give him a scene, and then he's zooming in on the photograph.
Yeah, and then Leon, the tortoise, you know, kind of he was kind of the dumb, kind of a little bit more dense kind of character, and the story of the tortoise aligns with him.
Great to see Brian James.
Yeah, he was so good in this as well. I mean, they're small parts, but they're significant parts, and they all have a key kind of piece to play throughout the story.
And I personally love that ending. I totally get what you're saying about it working better if he's human. You're right. Yeah. But I just love the way that ending is delivered, with Edward James almost saying, you know, somebody's going to be after her.
Right.
And then finding the unicorn and flashing back to that line.
And the unicorn if you don't have the dream sequence, then the unicorn represents Rachel, which is kind of that unique find. You found something special here in this person, right? I mean, it's kind of like the last clue being left there to him is basically James Olmos's character telling him, this is your one chance to get, you know, to get whatever you can out of this life, right? And
well, right, because it doesn't necessarily mean he's coming after him. Because, I mean, if he was coming after him, he could have had the jump on him there.
Well, and he left the unicorn behind. It's letting him know, I've been here already. I could have killed her. She was in your apartment and I could have taken care of her. But I'm giving you a chance here. And he lets them go.
And Ford looks at it, understands it, and like, let's get the fuck out of here before they change their mind. Right.
Exactly.
Which does leave room for a sequel.
Yes.
And an amazing sequel it was. I gotta tell you, I know that we don't want to delve into the sequel, but
just a quick question. Does it officially finally answer the question?
It does not, but I think in a way, that being said, in a way, Villeneuve makes the question irrelevant, so that no matter what you think, whether he is or he isn't a replicant, it doesn't matter. It tells a beautiful story that, to me, enhances the original film. I appreciate the original Blade Runner so much more after seeing 2049 and what it brings to it, that and he's able to do it without at any point delving into that question. Villeneuve himself has been quoted as saying, the movie that I grew up with was the one that I saw in theater, and I know it has the narration and also he's like basically saying, take that for what you will. That's the story that I know, and that's the story that I grew up with, that had no unicorn, no reference to Deckard being a replicant. So I think he was operating from a place where he believed he was a human, but he doesn't answer the question.
And we all have those stories or those things as pieces of art that we grew up with and we love, even though we know they're very flawed.
Yeah. They call it the Xanadu effect. Like, if you ever, I remember having seen the movie Xanadu when I was young and thinking it was the most amazing thing in the world. And if I watch it now, it's just like, oh my God, how could I have ever thought this was anything but trash? But yeah, that's the Xanadu effect for you.
The original Star Wars, let's be honest, the acting was not good.
Of course not. It's a kid's movie.
Yeah, nostalgia says, does a lot for us.
Yeah. On to sequels and remakes.
Yeah.
Philip K. Dick's friend K.W. Jeter wrote three authorized Blade Runner novels that continue Rick Deckard's story, attempting to resolve the differences between the film and the original novel. These are Blade Runner 2, The Edge of Human. That was so 80s. 95, though. Very 80s. Yeah. Blade Runner 3, Replicant Night, and Blade Runner 4, Eye and Talon. I'm sure they're very good novels, but those subtitles are just...
I only read the first one. I read Edge of Human, and I actually owned a signed copy from by the author of Edge of Human at one point. I've lost it by now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It does try to reconcile in the original Android Dream of Electric Sheep, the character of J.F. Sebastian. There's a character like him, but it's not called J.F. Sebastian. In that book, Edge of Human, they tried to reconcile those two. They actually, in those, both characters exist in the universe of the novel. That's one of the few things I remember about it. And then as far as it, they have no bearing on what happened later with Blade Runner 2049.
49 doesn't reference them at all. Okay. Blade Runner co-writer David Peoples wrote the 1998 action film Soldier, which he referred to as a side sequel, or spiritual successor to the original film. The two are set in a shared universe.
Soldier's terrible movie. It's a Kurt Russell film.
Soldier.
There is one scene in a garbage dump where you can see a police spinner in the dump crash there. That's pretty much the only direct reference. If you didn't know that and didn't know what the author had said, it could just be a generic sci-fi film.
The sad thing is the sequel, though, to this. I mean, there could have been an immediate sequel of the two of them, you know, on the run or whatever. So, I mean, that's the only disappointing thing about a sequel being, you know, 30 years into the future.
Yeah.
I was disappointed by Ryan Gosling, but I'll have to say it to totally make up my mind about that. A bonus feature on the Blu-ray for Prometheus, the 2012 film by Scott, set in the Alien universe, states that Eldon Tyrell, CEO of the Blade Runner Tyrell Corporation, was the mentor of Guy Pearce's character, Peter Weyland.
Oh, nice. How come no one has started a robotics company called Tyrell?
So now we're supposed to believe that the Alien universe coexists with the Blade Runner universe. So
Alien takes place much later, apparently.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, because they're talking about the off-world colonies.
Replicants.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So you get this advertisement. Think about this. All of those ads you see for off-world colonies being this paradise, and you go out there, and there is a shithole where you get devoured by aliens.
Yes.
That kind of establishes that the replicants in the alien universe are kind of hybrids. They're mechanical.
Bishop.
Biological. Yeah. So they are partly mechanical, I suppose.
They could be.
Well, and again, not to spoil the 2049 movie, but in 2049 they do establish in the aftermath of what happened in Blade Runner, how replicants have had to change.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which sets up the changes for the replicants later in the Alien movies.
Potentially, okay. Yeah.
And then, of course, 2049 with Gosling in its starring role, set decades after the first film, Matt Ford reprising his role as Rick Deckard. How bad is Gosling?
I have to tell you, he is very good in this movie. You will be pleasantly surprised. Okay. And again, I don't want to spoil it for you, but I say, especially now that you have it fresh in your mind, I would recommend seeing it.
So, you know, this is why I didn't see it in the first place, because I wanted to watch this first.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find this anywhere. This was like, I mean, we had to rent this off of Google.
It's on YouTube for rent for like $4.
Yeah, to rent on YouTube.
So one thing that I would recommend Denis Villeneuve commissioned, speaking of sequels and remakes, Denis Villeneuve commissioned three shorts to be made upon the release of 2049, kind of leading up to the release of 2049. I believe all three are available on YouTube. One of them is an animated one. It's done anime style. I believe it's one of the Animatrix guys who did it. And then the other two are live action. One of them stars Batista, who is in 2049, and the other one stars the actor. Is it Jared Leto who's in the So I would recommend that you after having seen this movie, watch those three shorts first, and then jump into 2049. Okay. Because what it does is that it kind of helps fill in that 30-year gap. And they do follow a chronological order. I believe the animated one comes first, then the Batista one, and then the other one. Or they're called by the year. So it's like Blade Runner, 2022, Blade Runner, whatever. So I would recommend that you check those out. And to anybody else out there who hasn't seen 2049, they are on YouTube. Watch them and then watch the film. And I think you will be pleasantly surprised. If you thought Blade Runner was slow, 2049 is pretty slow too. So, okay. John, make sure you take a good nap. Start early.
Going into this one knowing it was paced like that made it easier.
And it's okay if you pause it halfway and take a nap and come back to it and finish it off later. That's perfectly fine. But
I didn't have any problem with the pacing of this. But then, sometimes a movie takes time. And this one...
I think modern movies have just ruined my attention span. That and watching all of YouTube.
Well, yeah, we're watching a bunch of cartoons now instead. That's really what it comes down to.
And I will say that I don't care what else Jared Leto does. He's always going to be the guy from My So-Called Life to me.
And he kind of plays that character in 2049. He's kind of an emo character, the way that he plays it through. 2049 is a longer movie than Blade Runner. I mean, interestingly enough, the final cut is shorter than the theatrical cut.
That's what I thought.
Scott actually made a tighter film in creating the director's cut that came out in the 90s and then eventually the final cut. So Villeneuve does take his time telling his story. Some people have complained that it's too long. I personally just revel again in the world building that's created around it. And in a sense, Blade Runner 2049 delivers on the promise of a mystery film of a detective trying to solve a mystery in a way that Blade Runner does not.
And we get the grizzled curmudgeonly Ford that we know and love.
You that's one aspect that I wish had not been included in the marketing, was that Harrison Ford was in the film. Cause I think if you see the movie, I think you will, it would have been awesome to not know that he was going to be in it.
It needed all the help it could get though. Commercially, though.
That's the problem. The theater, and even that didn't work.
And when you make a sequel so many years later, you have to do something to really promote it.
But I think, like its predecessor, I mean, Blade Runner was a commercial disappointment and it earned a cult following through the years. I think 2049 is destined for the same future. It was a commercial disappointment. Critically, I think it was well accepted. And I think years to come, it's going to be considered one of the least appreciated sci-fi films out there. And truly, I think a worthy successor that elevates the original film.
And probably failed for a similar reason, the pacing. If they both have similar pacing, action movies were in vogue in the early 80s, it's even more so now.
The other movie in theaters out at the time was Thor Ragnarok. Think about it. It's like so different, right? We've gotten
one movie I had to tap out of because it was just too ridiculous.
And granted, I'm all for campy and fun and whatnot too, but it kind of has impacted us in a way that we just don't have the patience for this kind of stuff.
All right, on to brains.
On to brains.
My only issue with it is the pacing, and I know that's a me thing more than a movie thing, so I'm going to go 5.
The only thing I would complain about would be the soundtrack. Vangelis just really, I mean, they were just doing a knockoff Pink Floyd there in some parts. Like, so yeah, the future is Pink Floyd from 1976. All right. I mean, there's like one part where you think they're even trying to play Shine On You Crazy Diamond, just kind of a knockoff version of it. But I'll still give it a 5, though.
And obviously, Roberto.
I don't even have to say. I mean, this is always going to be a 5 brain or 5 star or 5 replicants score from me. So.
So what have we learned?
Well, we learned that if they patented those light-up umbrellas, they'd probably make more money than both of these movies combined. Because it rains a fucking lot in 2019.
And I learned that nothing dates a movie more than a Yamaha DX7. It's what I like to call the official synthesizer of the 80s. Everybody used it back then. And Vangelis used it a ton on this film. I went back and watched clips of a DX7, and I know the patches he used. And it is so classically 80s.
And then they like reused it again for Terminator, that end credit music. It was like the exact same thing.
Yeah. And I learned, similar to John, that nothing dates a movie like a defunct company logo, whether it's Atari or Pan Am or the Bell Corporation. Those things can date you very quickly. But
they put their money in the wrong horse.
Interestingly enough, in 2049, they play with the fact that this is a universe where those companies still exist, so they still keep the same logo, and they still don't use cell phones in 2049.
Oh, that's great.
One of the two cardinal mistakes of science fiction. Either not setting it far enough in the future, or which this came close to. This is borderline.
It's borderline, yeah.
Or assuming technology is not going to change enough.
Honestly, this should have been 2049.
Yeah. I've always said, anything that you think of as far as setting something in the future, when you're all said and done, add 1,000 years to it, and then you can't go wrong. That's why, bringing it all back full circle to Dune, that's why I appreciate that Dune takes place like in the year 30,000 or something ridiculous like that.
One of the things I've always loved about Firefly, it's set like a couple of thousand years in the future.
Yeah.
I heard about the classic Star Trek where they had like the analog counter they're watching the counter turn. It's like they don't even have digital and they're in space.
Yeah.
Come on.
Little plastic dials.
All right, so thanks for joining us, Roberto. Is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah.
I do a podcast for Game of Thrones called A Pod of Casts, and Game of Thrones Season 8 is coming back, which means that our podcast is coming back. We're going to be recording a few episodes in the lead-up to the beginning of Season 8, where we are to be taking a look back at Season 1 and talking about Season 1 and how maybe it helped set up some of the things that are going to be happening in Season 8. And then we're going to be, Abe and I are going to be podcasting all through the new season. So go to apodofcasts.com if you want to check it out.
Say that again. I was talking over.
apodofcasts.com.
I'm definitely going to have to check out those lead-in episodes, but Season 1 especially.
Can 6 episodes really live up to the years of waiting that we've had?
I don't know. I was just looking at my notes from the last time we recorded. It's like, oh my God, we haven't recorded an episode since August of 2017. This is crazy.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to have plugs, because I know it's been a while.
It's been a long time.
Oh, and real quick, yes, this is new. If you want to hear more about it, watch the hearing, because it's music related.
Yeah.
And that's it for Blade Runner, The Final Cut. Until next time, and we'll be reviewing The Island, continuing this double trilogy.
2019, baby.
Always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life,
there you are.
There you are.